All right, guys. Hey, we're back. I may sound a little winded because I just ran down the steps. No, actually, I came back from the airport from work travel. So I'm a little bit jet lagged and exhausted, but that might also be the old age. So good to end the Friday, or end the week, I should say, talking to some pretty awesome people. And then also getting on this podcast with you guys. So,
you are listening to No U-Turn, a podcast about the exciting changes in transportation and the people that play a key role leading us into the future. There may be some detours along the way, but there's no turning back. And now to your hosts, Basil Yap, Chris Fernando, and Ravi Singh.
Today's kind of a different episode. We've got Clint Harper back with us to join us on some discussion points. So we'll jump in here in just a sec. But hope you guys are getting ready for February. I know you guys are a little bit cold in the East Coast. We got some rain on the West Coast in LA, so everybody's paddling around in flooded streets in some places. But kind of sunny here today on Friday, and I know you guys are excited for the Eagles to be in the Super Bowl. So,
Taylor Swift to be in the Super Bowl.
Oh, the Eagles. Oh, it didn't make it. Yes, at least one of the Kelce brothers made it. So, I'm pretty excited. You pretty excited to see Taylor Swift, Basil?
Yeah. My daughters certainly are.
Nothing about the game, just Taylor Swift. That's great. Good for her.
I will have to say, my daughter watched a lot more Chiefs games this year than ever before.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's a good story, but
we need to get Taylor Swift in AM. That's what we need to do.
Yeah,
fly into one of her concerts in like a eVTOL.
That could be pretty awesome. Next album, next concert, right? 1989 tour. She's redoing that. That's a great idea. Maybe Clint. Let's bring her to LA, and you can help kind of navigate through all that policy and approvals and make it happen for Tay Tay.
Just make it happen.
That's what we're gonna talk about today. So we have our guest back, Clint, and who was on how many episodes ago? Were you on, Clint? I should have known coming into this.
It's one of your favorite episodes.
One of as I was mentioning, we do talk a lot about advanced mobility. Ravi was talking about coming back from the airport, and obviously airports are a key part of our aviation infrastructure. And as we know, with advanced air mobility or air taxis, a key part of that infrastructure is vertiports. And we have been talking about vertiports for a long time now. And this idea of vertiport or vertistop is not terribly new, because in the 90s, when some of the projects around struggling now with the name, the Osprey, we thought that the similar tilt rotor aircraft were going to have a commercial civilian use, and there was an interest in designing vertiports and understanding how they would be different than heliports, and there was actually a standard. And but we've evolved a lot since then, because we're primarily focused on electric or hybrid vehicles now. And maybe to set the stage, I'll just mention some of the work in North Carolina, which is one of many places that have been looking at advanced air mobility. In 2020, we had a first public demonstration where the EHang aircraft came in and flew with nobody in it, but was able to fly around and a demonstration before a large transportation summit event. And the idea was really just get folks excited to see it in person and say, okay, this is actually a reality now. And they could hear it, and they're like, wow, this thing is really quiet. It was actually kind of windy that day too, so they could see that it did well in the wind. And so we were really starting to think about, okay, what are the infrastructure requirements? And how should the state be thinking about investing in this? And so, since then, really the first step I think that's happened has been BETA putting a charging station in using state funds from the North Carolina DOT at an airport outside of Raleigh. And we'll probably continue to see small steps like that at airports. But enough about that. Let's throw it over to Clint, because Clint has spent a lot of time both in Utah and LA and even probably beyond that in his role now, looking at vertiports. And so, yeah, Clint, let's toss it back to you. Welcome back. You know, let's maybe start with where where are we at? Like, maybe just like high level. Like, has anyone built a vertiport yet?
To my knowledge, no one's built a vertiport yet. You know, there's a lot of work going on around the country and around the world, you know, with different projects that have been announced, different efforts. I think in the United States, you know, the furthest along that anybody's really gotten is in Virginia with the Navos proposal, which was announced that they've submitted a 7480-1 with the FAA to activate a new facility. They received their the news seemed like they received their letter of determination back, and they're ready to move on to the next steps, which of course doesn't mean that anything has actually been built, that they've just started the process, which is exciting nonetheless. Doing some research, found out over in France, you know, for the Paris Olympics, you know, there's a number of facilities that are being transitioned, existing airports and heliport facilities that are being transitioned to be used for eVTOLs and Volocopters aircraft. And again, you know, on top of that, you know, a lot of announcements, a lot of, I guess, a desire. But to my knowledge, you know, on an actual purpose-built vertiport, no one's actually put a shovel into the ground yet.
Wow. And who were we seeing, you know, take the step to these steps to get the vertiports established? Is it local government? Is it commercial? Is it maybe a hybrid, a public-private partnership?
You know, it's interesting. In the United States, I'd say it's majority, you know, privately driven. So most of the facilities that we're talking about, you know, are, you know, being looked at either by an OEM or a vertiport developer. There are a handful of cities that are interested in vertiport development that I've talked to. Most of them are on the fringes of larger cities, and they don't really get the attention I think that they deserve in terms of their interest in vertiports and what they want to do and being on the edge. And of course, you know, we know that one vertiport really isn't going to do it. You know, you need a network. And so I think some of these smaller cities that are looking to get on the wave, you know, or waiting for someone else to say, hey, yeah, we want to be the other end of that node. And hopefully that'll create a, you know, some kind of a effect where other cities are going to jump on and we'll have a network that's going to establish. But that's really, you know, where we're at a high level right now.
Yeah, that's a good point of requiring a network. And I mean, in your kind of research and work in the past, is there like a minimum number of nodes that you need, and then are there existing infrastructure that can be used as maybe one of those nodes?
Yeah, so off the top of my head, I can reference the NASA SATS, the Small Airport Transport System study, you know, that talked about has a lot of parallels to what's being envisioned now with the urban air mobility, but you have to scale it to an urban perspective. You know, of course, it was talking about more akin to what's regional air mobility today. But nonetheless, you know, there's some interesting tidbits in there. And so I think to answer your question, there's, you know, it's different for every city, you know, and different depending on the market demand, different depending on, you know, what other ways are you making money off the vertiport? Do you need to have, you know, an aircraft in and out, you know, constantly, you know, to get a return on investment? You know, there's a lot of factors that go into this, you know, that, you know, we're starting to hear questions from real estate developers on what does a pro forma look like, you know, for a vertiport development? Is it even going to be worth us even bringing it to our financiers, you know, as a part of a project, you know? And so I think, you know, that level of work is highlighting where we're at, you know, that things are, you know, more people are getting interested, you know, there's more, I guess, due diligence being done behind the validity of having a vertiport in a system, you know, within a region or a city. But we're still in the infancy of that, still trying to populate those fields on, you know, what it's going to take, what it's going to cost, what are the components that you need, what's the demand look like, you know, what is the socioeconomic profile of the folks that are going to be using it. You know, all of those are, you know, largely unknown outside of maybe some of the vertiport developers who have done deep dives into this.
Has there been any, so let's revisit some of the the earlier stuff, I guess, from a few years ago, like on the mission types. Has that really changed from what we talked about, like I said, a few years ago to now? Are we seeing that shift to a different direction, or pretty much stay the same in terms of mission types?
You know, it's actually, you know, pretty exciting. In talking to some of the cities and jurisdictions out there, there is significantly more interest in more of the emergency and disaster response types of use cases. And, you know, you see some things going on in Utah. They're looking at an emergency response use cases, you know, that might be supplemented by a cargo corridor. So I think on the government side, on the public side of the house, you know, mm-hmm. they do see some societal benefits that can be extracted from these kinds of services. On the private side, you know, the developers, you know, I think there's still a lot of eggs in the air taxi basket, you know, but you do start seeing more attention being given to some of the cargo use cases and, you know, the emergency response. But having that intersect actual infrastructure plans, you know, I haven't seen a news release yet that I can think of that says, hey, we want to do air taxi, but we also want to do emergency management or disaster response, and that's going to be built into our plans.
How different do you think the infrastructure will be if based on the mission types? I mean, there will be overlap and similarities, but let's say cargo versus passenger, do you see having to, you know, plan very differently for those mission types?
Not in terms of airfield geometry, you know, so what is the TLOF, the FADO, the approach departure surfaces, the other Part 77 surfaces, you know, that are going to protect the airspace. You know, I think those are probably going to be pretty good for the cargo missions. You know, it seems like a lot of the cargo USs that are out there right now are lighter. They're a little bit smaller footprint. So, you know, if you build a vertiport for an air taxi use case and build it according to the standards that are out there, you know, mm-hmm. I think you're going to be pretty safe with in terms of just the geometric design of the facility. Now, when you get into, are they going to have similar charging needs? Are they going to have different levels of autonomy or simplified vehicle operations or remote pilot capabilities that's going to drive, you know, different kinds of infrastructure, C2 requirements and those kind of things on the ground? You know, that's what I think we need to learn a little bit more about the capabilities of the aircraft that are going to be using to know, you know, what that looks like and what kind of footprint that's going to demand on the ground.
C2 is command and control. We'll probably throw that in there quickly. Oh.
Correct. Sorry.
It's not quite an acronym, but we should, yeah.
I feel like there's one thing that I was thinking about the other day here in LA. You know, you're seeing a lot of these major infrastructure projects, whether it's the airport or, you know, the rail project somewhere else in the city, and you're seeing a big delay in schedule. So delivery of those critical, you know, infrastructure pieces that we need to make, you know, AAM or advanced air mobility or whatever, realistic or you know, actually occur and happen on time. Have we seen those schedules, the reality of just the process and all these requirements and the big potential roadblocks that may pop up like that could really derail things? Have we seen that kind of sync with what the AAM folks are doing, the OEMs are, you know, planning for and around their own schedules? Do they even think about those things? Because, you know, that's huge, because we have the Olympics coming up, and then, you know, we've got some critical projects that are not going to be done before the Olympics in LA. So it's something I was thinking about when I was reading a few different articles and also, you know, talking to my other colleagues here in our industry, just about the impact of those delays. Yeah, that scares me, because we could actually see things make some great progress and come together, and all of a sudden, wham, you know, you're delayed another year or so. So it's just, I don't know if that's been discussed from, actually, I'll open it up to all three of you guys. What you guys been hearing?
I'm just going to note, Ravi tries to say LA as many times as he can during an episode. So make sure we're always referencing so much.
Repping LA.
Essentially, Robbie's asking, they're building cars, and have we built the roads? I mean, it's a good question. And I'll just make a quick comment, then throw it to the other two. I don't think we've been through the process yet to really know the unknowns, right? So we don't have a certified vehicle aircraft. Mm-hmm. And so no one's gone through the process to really, you know, when you first go through the process, it's much longer. But once you learn the process, you can speed it up. But we have to do that first.
Yeah, I'd say one thing with those big infrastructure projects that I learned during my time with the Utah Department of Transportation is, you know, those delays a lot of times are caused by, you know, materials. You know, when you're laying miles and miles and miles of roadway, you know, that's a lot of materials, you know, that you have to source and get on, you know, get to the site. You know, the labor, you know, that's going to put all that together is also in demand. They're trying to sequence all that in there. And so there's, with these large infrastructure projects, there's a lot of moving parts, you know, that, you know, little things that you wouldn't, you know, often think of can throw, you know, a monkey wrench into it all. One of the examples is we had a big roadway project, you know, that was going on, and it got delayed significantly because of the hurricane that hit Florida, you know, that spring, because all the workers, all the laborers, and all the materials were down in Florida, you know, making sure, you know, enabling that kind of recovery, you know. And so looking at that, you know, I guess from that perspective into an eVTOL or vertiport project, you know, significantly less materials, you know, probably less labor. I think where the real question mark is on the availability of the charging infrastructure, you know. And so if you're going to need, you know, transformers, you know, to tie into the local grid, you know, some of those transformers, like 18 to 24 months, you know, so that's something that's going to have to be sequenced into, you know, the development process, which would be a part of the pro forma that the real estate developers are looking at to see what are the risks, when do we buy the land, when do we start developing the land, you know, so they know exactly when, you know, they feel like they're going to get a, start making a return on investment, you know, from everything.
That's a great point. That's a great point with the materials.
Yeah, I mean, I would say quickly that infrastructure is behind for the most part. I think everyone, as Basil mentioned, focused on the aircraft. We're inching closer and closer, but I think infrastructure is going to, you know, probably be, you know, slow moving for a lot of things that we will discuss over the next hour or so. But yeah, we're going to have a real challenge. I guess my biggest worry is that how do airports or city, local, even states balance existing needs, priorities, funding with this new what-if scenario. And since it's not proven out, I feel like local politics, local needs, priorities will likely win over, which will probably slow things down further. So I think that's my biggest concern for a lot of geographies, not just in the US, around the world, a lot of competing interests.
Yeah, and that's the million-dollar response. Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head right there. You know, when you look at what's going to need to happen from a local jurisdiction perspective, you know, is a vertiport going to require a zoning change? Is there, you know, a permit, you know, discretionary approval process that you're going to have to navigate? You know, most of those involve a public process, you know, which kind of gets back to the whole engagement, stakeholder outreach, you know, side of things, where if we know this is going to take a while, you know, and we know the vertiports are going to be delayed to an extent because we don't have an aircraft. Those are very good points. And I think important points to remember when, you know, we ask the questions, do we have any vertiports yet, with a little bit of impatience, you know, in under our breath, you know, is recognizing that, you know, that we have time to figure things out. And I think the time is now to be conducting that stakeholder outreach, to let communities know what's going on, you know, so that the first time that they hear about AAM isn't at a public meeting where they're trying to, you know, make a zoning change to allow for a vertiport to be put in people's backyards.
Yeah, exactly. What do you think the state of regulation is currently at the federal level in particular, but even at the state local level?
There's a lot of opportunities. I'll put it that way. There's just a lot of opportunities to, you know, to streamline and to optimize and to do some good things. So I've been engaged in this topic probably three or four times just this week on, you know, what is the role of states and cities, you know, in the whole vertiport development process. And, you know, it's interesting, you know, so I kind of gave you a quick snapshot of what it looks like at the federal level. You know, if you have a proponent, you know, they have their facility, they design it, they submit a 7480-1 through the FAA. That kicks off an aeronautical study. Aeronautical study looks at the facility design, integration with the airspace, among other things, and then at the output of it, you know, kicks out a letter of determination, which is, you know, objectionable, conditional, or no objection. You know, and these letter of authorities, it's important to note, have no inherent or letter of determinations have no inherent authority attached to them. They're not an approval, you know. And so one of the news media articles that I saw on the Virginia vertiport, you know, talked about the FAA approved the first vertiport. Well, highly unlikely they approved it. They issued a letter of determination that was, you know, hopefully with no objection, you know, and that's probably what it was. You know, then depending on what state you're in, you're going to go to the state aeronautics division. And, you know, for example, in California, they have a heliport permitting process. So does California. So does Illinois. And, you know, you kind of go through that whole due diligence process again, you know, and, you know, they look through things and say, all right, well, is this going to be safe? Does it meet our local standards? You know, the local sensitivities and specific context that we have within our state, you know, does it pass muster? And if it does, that's great. And I'm speaking to this linearly, and it doesn't really happen linearly. It happens, you know, kind of all at once,
right.
You know, and so they get a permit at the state level and then take it to the local jurisdictions. And so, you know, a large city might have a conditional permit, conditional use permit process, you know, that also requires that letter of determination. Well, by the time you get down to there, you know, one of the things that I've highlighted in my congressional testimony last year was, is that there isn't I haven't found a planning program, an AICP, American Planning Association approved planning program that even talks about aviation planning or includes aviation planning, you know, as a part of the curriculum.
Wow.
You know, and so when, you know, the local planners, you know, get these applications and get these designs that talk about the approach departure pass, talk about the Part 77 surfaces and what all that means, you know, chances are that they're, you know, putting a lot of faith in the proponent and, you know, with some established precedent, you know, from people that have been there for a while, you know, that they know, you know, what's good and what's bad, you know, and I've, you know, looked at some heliports, you know, and I'm sure we all seen them, you know, that are clearly bad. You know, they have obstructions, you know, galore, they've hazards all over the place. And that's the way they were built. And so as far as the state of the regulations, I think, you know, there's a lot of opportunities to start working with state and local authorities on that and to help them understand, you know, what does it mean if you have an obstruction in the 8-1 approach departure surface? You know, what does that mean? Does it mean that the facility is no good and it has to be disapproved? You know, there's some people that would say, yes, definitely. That means it's an unsafe facility. There's some folks that say, no, there's, you know, there's ways to mitigate the risk associated with that. And, you know, there's everything in between, but, you know, but the approval authority, you know, needs to be able to work through those and should have a record of decision on, you know, we approve this and we recognize that there's an obstruction in the 8-1 approach departure surface, but, you know, we put this condition on it saying they're going to light it, they're going to mark it, they're going to chart it, they're going to do, you know, the things that normally happens in aviation, you know, and with that, we feel that the risk is mitigated low, provided that there's a certain tempo of operations threshold that never gets exceeded. I mean, you can go into detail on this, but that's never discussed in any kind of planning programs, you know, in the United States. And so, you know, planners need help.
Right. So something that's going to drive regulation, whether it's using or updating existing or developing new policies and regs, is siting, right? Where are we going to put these vertiports? Three questions that I like to ask. We discussed a couple of episodes ago with you when we had siting vertiports is, you know, who are we trying to help? Who may get hurt and who will be left out? So with those three kind of questions, overarching questions in mind, talk to us a little bit about kind of your thought process when we're thinking about siting and maybe bucket it in near term, because I'm just understanding near term, we're going to have to enable early operations and then maybe further or long term, which is more mid long term. The ideal scenario, because I think there's a little bit of push and pull, right? We want to plan for the best for long term, but we really don't, you know, like Basil said, we don't know the unknowns. So what are your thoughts on kind of, if Clint Harper is running the show, how would you enable near term operations through sighting. Big, big question.
Can I just make a quick comment? Just a quick clarifying, I guess, comment as I was listening. So you did a great job, Clint, of the overview. And so maybe just kind of to summarize, the federal government kind of they have oversight of the airspace, right? So as soon as you're in the air, you're kind of in federal jurisdiction. But state and local governments have oversight of things on the ground. So like where you actually have to land falls at a local level, a state or a local level. So I think that's an important distinction. And then where the FAA or the federal government comes in, to your point about, you know, the determination letter, is they're just simply saying, okay, you've chose a spot. You, a non-federal agency, has chose a spot, and we're just giving you some feedback on how you're going to enter into the airspace and if it is going to be an issue for us or not. I'm kind of oversimplifying. So I guess when Chris is asking your question about siting, the siting is not at the federal level. It's really going to be a local government or a commercial entity, I guess, that's making that investment, trying to find a spot.
Yeah, you're spot on. You know, and the roles and responsibilities is important. You know, it's important context to set. And, you know, typically when I talk about this, you know, with, like, for example, my CAMI 101 efforts that I do with Yolanka, you know, shout out to CAMI. You know, but,
oh, yeah.
You know, how I try and picture this, if you look at Title 14 of the Codified Federal Regulations, 14 CFR, you know, it's broken down in these chapters, and you can look at those chapters and see, you know, who has regulatory authority, you know, over what. Yeah. And, you know, the way the FAA describes it, you know, you got the aircraft, you got the airspace, you got the operation, you got the infrastructure, and you got the community. Well, according to 14 CFR, you know, the FAA has jurisdiction over the aircraft, the airspace, and the operations. You know, those are covered under various chapters of that regulation. Where things meet the ground on the infrastructure side and how the community is impacted, you know, that's all locally regulated. You know, and so, yeah, your summation was spot on there. And you're going to have to wrap it back.
So, Clint, how are we going to cite them? Like, to Chris's question, you know, about the citing, which is a super difficult process.
Yeah.
And I think, I guess I'll repeat some of it, in that the reason I would love to hear your take is, right now, you know, you're one of the, you know, few voices that has gone in depth on this topic with, you know, maybe Rex Alexander and a few others. And so, you know, it is very much educated opinion based, very experienced educated opinion based. So that's why I would love for you to kind of talk through what is important to kind of consider at the outset that can make or break the market.
Yeah. So, yeah, you know, I'll answer it this way. So, the fortunate thing about all this is that this isn't completely brand new. You know, jurisdictions and cities typically have some kind of experience in siting heliports. You know, if a new hospital is developed, you know, with a heliport, often it's considered an accessory use of the hospital, and there's an approval process for that. You know, some cities have some jurisdictions or some regulations for a privately developed heliport. You know, so we can take some of the lessons from that to understand, you know, what are the sensitivities around this, because those regulations and the passing of those regulations had to go through a public process. And, you know, to the extent that, you know, people showed up and provided their input on that process, you know, we can, you know, reasonably assume that that's a good starting point. And so you got to look at the negative externalities. And so this is, you know, kind of the conundrum that aviation is in right now, where across airports and heliports, and that, you know, for the most part, the people that have direct access and direct utility out of the airports don't live near the airports. You know, and the people that live near the airports don't have direct access or direct utility out of that, but they have to deal with the negative externalities, and whether that be noise, emissions, vibration, you know, they have to deal with the airport, you know, with that. And so it creates an unfair and inequitable balance. And so starting from that perspective, you know, it gives you a good starting point of what problems we're trying to solve. And I think the low hanging fruit there is we can come in and say eVTOLs, you know, are shown to be, you know, much, much quieter. You know, hopefully we'll have a smaller vibration footprint, you know, to neighboring facilities. And, you know, much appreciation to Joby and NASA for the work that they've done, you know, showing how quiet these aircraft can actually be. But then you got to also get to the, you know, the issues around perceived safety, around, you know, all the other negative externalities that are going to, you know, that you have to think about, you know, and there's cities that, you know, look at their role, you know, in their geography, not just for the people, but, you know, Los Angeles, you know, considers a local wildlife, you know, and, you know, what is the impact going to be on the local wildlife? What is the impact going to be on the ecosystem? You know, if you're within, I think it's 11 miles of the shore, then you have to, you know, bring the Coastal Commission in there and let them weigh in on the decisions, you know, so. Yeah. You know, the list can get long and drawn out, you know, on what kind of considerations you, you know, you have to look at. In fact, there's a NASA paper that I had the privilege of co-authoring with Rex Alexander and Nancy Mendoza and Gabriela Juarez with the City of Los Angeles, you know, where we just kind of brainstormed all the possible things that you could, you know, have to think about. And I want to say I could be way off here, but I'm just going to go for it. I want to say it was, you know, over 400 considerations.
That was a long, long list.
Yeah. Yeah. So it doesn't stop, you know, I guess it doesn't stop just with noise, you know, and, you know, you also got to think about the frequency. So one of the things, like in, you know, many cities, I've seen heliports have a operational cap on them with 3 operations a day. And that operational cap was instituted because they figured that at 3 operations a day, you weren't going to exceed 65 decibels averaged over the day and night, which is 65 DNL, as the FAA describes it. You know, and so if you wanted to take one of those heliports and convert it into a vertiport, well, if you want any kind of real utility out of it, you're also going to have to look at that operational cap. And that takes you, you know, back into public process where you got to, you know, go through all this again.
3 operations a day.
That's 3 crazy. Operations a day, which results in landing fees that can be anywhere from $900 to $1,500.
Woo, man.
Because you got to make, you got to pay the bills on 3 operations a day.
That was going to be my next comment. Like, all right, yeah, they're covering the cost, that infrastructure cost and maintenance cost, O&M cost. Man.
And you know that they're not actually getting 3 operations a day, you know, so that's also being factored in, you know.
Yeah, that's that's definitely interesting to hear a restriction of only 3 operations a day and that someone agreed to that as reasonable. So it must have certainly had a felt like there's a business case there. You mentioned earlier about, you know, the siting process, and you mentioned like hospitals where there is a helipad, and that's serving the public. You're hopefully improving healthcare outcomes by having that mode of transportation or access to that mode of transportation there at the hospital. Like, you know, what's the public perception, I guess, when we think about just moving people, not for the public good, so to speak, like a medevac use case, as well as maybe even just moving high value cargo.
Yeah, that you get right back into the battles that are being faced, you know, like at Santa Monica Airport, the Whiteman Airport, and, you know, a lot of other airports that are, you know, at threat of some kind of closure or reduction of services because people are sick of having to deal with the noise and the emissions and, you know, the issues without having, you know, any kind of perceived benefit, you know, from those facilities. And I think if you position vertiports as facilities that are just available for air taxi uses, you know, you've created a one-trick pony that isn't going to serve the people, you know, that are going to be impacted by the negative externalities. And there are going to be negative externalities associated with these facilities. You know, that's just the nature of the beast. And so, you know, my contention has always been is that, you know, every vertiport has to be a 10-trick pony. And, you know, I submitted a white paper response to the USDOT RFI last year that talked about vertiports as resiliency hubs and offering an idea, you know, of how vertiports can be, you know, more than a one-trick pony for communities, you know, because I think that's if the community can understand that, yes, you know, on the day-to-day, you know, those facilities are catering to, you know, wealthier people. You know, but in the event of emergency or disaster, you know, those facilities are available, you know, for disaster response and to serve the community and to be a point of resiliency for that community. You know, then there's at least that, you know, that you can sleep at night that, you know, that facility is there, you know, waiting for that situation.
So, Clint, what about, you know, there's been quite a bit on weather and everything else, but I guess a good tie in there would be the digital infrastructure side of things. You know, there's been quite a bit I've seen, obviously, outside of AEM on digital infrastructure. And then you look at specifically with AEM, a lot of the weather focused discussion or efforts, research, I've seen that pick up quite a bit in the last couple of years. What have you seen there from your experience? And, you know, again, I'll open it back up to Chris and Basil as well to jump in there after you.
Yeah, well, I mean, you look at weather, you know, and I go back to, you know, when I was helping file flight plans in the Air Force, you know, when we took a form from a flight crew, the three things we had to check, you know, did they indicate that they checked their weather? Did they indicate that they checked their NOTAMs, and did they sign the flight plan, you know, acknowledging all that? You know, of course, you know, we had to make sure their route, their altitude and everything else was good, but we would not take that flight plan from them if they didn't indicate that they checked the weather NOTAMs and then signed it, you know, showing that they checked all that stuff. So it highlights the importance of weather, you know, in this whole equation. And that's been, you know, something that the Wright brothers, you know, took into consideration on their first flight. You know, so weather is critical. And, you know, it gets really interesting in the land of heliports. I think helicopters are amazing, you know, inventions, amazing machines, you know, but they do have limitations, you know, and I think, you know, those limitations, not recognizing and giving respect to the limitations that helicopters have, has resulted in unnecessary injury or death, you know, and many times over, you know, and so, you know, many of those or a portion of those, you know, have been caused by, you know, wind effects, you know, that we weren't able to see with just a single wind cone, you know. And so now we're understanding that, you know, at a heliport today, you know, you have, you know, on one end of the spectrum, you have a $50 wind cone, you know, that is providing, you know, indications of weather and what's happening at that heliport for the pilot, that he can only see that, you know, as he's on approach. And mm-hmm. on the other end of the spectrum, you have, you know, anywhere from a $200,000 to a $500,000 AWOS, you know, with nothing really in between. Yeah. And so I think the contention out there is that, you know, we need something in between. We need other solutions. You know, we need some kind of digital infrastructure, some refined sensors. You know, if you look at the condition of most of the wind cones out there, I got folders of pictures of just jacked up wind cones, you know, that aren't going to provide anything to the operator. You know, so we need something that has, you know, higher fidelity, you know, more integrity to give this kind of data to the operators. And, you know, talking to pilots, you know, talking to Rex, you know, he talks about, you know, just different building anomalies, you know, having an elevator shaft, you know, located, you know, near your heliport and your TLOF area, you know, can have an impact when you're getting in there that you're not really noticing. Now, there's a great graphic that he shows in one of his presentations of how winds curl around the top of a building. And when your helicopter gets into that downward part of the curl, all of a sudden your helicopter is being thrusted downwards, which is not something that's probably enjoyable when you're trying to make a nice, easy landing. You know, and so understanding, you know, the wind effects and the micro weather situation, you know, around heliports and even for UAS operations is something that I feel doesn't get enough attention, you know, given its criticality and just given the criticality that weather, you know, has today in aviation decision making.
Yeah, you brought up a good point about AWOSs and ASOS, which are automated weather observations.
ASOS. ASOS is that service. Spaghetti sauce, right?
Yeah.
Remember our acronyms. What is ASOS and spaghetti sauce? Sorry. Remember the big rule, guys. We got to remember that. Acronyms. Let's spell them out. So Basil, I'm putting you on the spot.
All right. What is AWOS, we just mentioned, and ASOS is automated. What is ASOS? Automated surface observation. Yeah. Okay. Yep. So weather observation and surface observation, and those, like you said, are pretty high dollar pieces of equipment, and they are typically located at an airport on the ground within a certain distance from the runway, because that is the most critical part of flight. And and I think in kind of the informal rule of thumb, so to speak, is that they kind of serve the surface area for about 5 miles or less around that spot. But there's a lot of different things could impact that. So how much, Clint, do you think ASOS or AWOS costs? Is it tens of thousands? Is it hundreds of thousands?
An AWOS?
Yeah.
during my time with the state, I didn't see one that was less than $200,000.
Yeah. Yeah, I would have said probably $250,000 to get it installed, all the construction, everything, the siting. Yeah.
Yeah. And obviously,
so that's obviously unreasonable to just have that actually particular model everywhere in a city. So you make a really good point about, are there other sensors we can be using?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like I said, when you look at some of the wind cones that I've seen, having somebody out there, just lick their finger and stuck it in the air and say, yep, the wind's blowing this way, would it be better than having some of those wind cones?
So what about some of the other, great point on the weather. Obviously weather is critical. I think it's often forgot about, but maybe some of the other digital infrastructure at an airport, or sorry, at a vertiport. If I think about airports now, we have approach paths in there, but with a higher level of automation, what else are we thinking about that will be required at a vertiport? What are you seeing?
Well, we can talk about the other check box on the flight planning forum that I talked about, which is the NOTAMs, which is a notice to air missions message. There, I got that one. So, I'm going to bring this back to traditional aviation, because I think it's important that people understand, what these things are and how it relates to everything we've talked about so far. So, going back to our first conversation about, how an airfield is activated, you submit that 7480-1, which takes all this information about your airport. One of the products that comes out of that after it's activated is an airfield diagram and, just all the information that pilots would use to plan, their flights into your airfield or heliport. And so that includes things like runway width, runway length. Mm-hmm. If it's a heliport, the length and width of the TLOF, touchdown liftoff facility. Critical information that you would want to know. Right, two in a row.
Yay. Yeah.
Critical information that you would want to know about that facility. What altitude is it at? What kind of lights does it have? What markings does it have? So that you can make informed decisions about whether or not, your aircraft and your flight is suitable to fly in there. And if you, need to make any kind of decisions about alternate facilities, so on and so forth. And, that gives you the baseline of what your airfield is at. And, if you've worked in an airport, or a heliport, that baseline changes quite often, and so we use the NOTAMs to provide notification to the pilots and operators that something is different from that baseline, and so you might have construction on the runway where you've displaced your runway, 3,000 feet. So it's 3,000 feet shorter. That's probably something your air crews are going to want to know, if they're flying in on a hot day, and they're super heavy and they've planned for the full length of the runway. Another thing is markings. A marking is a critical component of a visual flight rules, a VFR approach. You have to have markings on your runway for it to be a VFR rated runway. And so if your markings are faded or have rubber deposits all over them, that's something you would want to communicate to your operators so they understand the situation that they're flying into. Now we look at the landscape for heliports out there, and the vast majority of heliports aren't on the NOTAM system. And so there's not a way, an official, FAA way of communicating to helicopter pilots what the condition of that heliport is. And so all those crappy windsocks that I saw out there that I have pictures of, that's something that could be sent out via NOTAM saying, hey, our wind cone sucks. It's torn. It's faded. It's bent. It doesn't spin. Light's broken. You can put those things on the NOTAM. And if a pilot, can look at that and say, well, I'm flying it at night. I've already got... maybe I'm on night vision, or maybe it's the visibility is a little bit bad. It's raining or something like that. And so it's going to take me a little bit longer to visually acquire that wind cone. Maybe it's a good idea for me to go to a different facility. That's a decision that that he would make off, or she would make off of that information, but right now that doesn't exist, And so heliports are kind of on their own in how they communicate with pilots on, the current status of their facilities. I mean, it can range from those wind cones to being completely closed. You might have a bulldozer, right in the middle of the TLOF. How would the helicopter know until he's on or she's on final approach? And I think that's the kind of a lead into some of the digital infrastructure challenges that we have. It's not what we think about, you know, traditionally with digital infrastructure that like cities like Los Angeles are working on, but it is a digital infrastructure challenge that I think needs some resolution before we start seeing a scaling of operations.
So could you touch a little bit on the, I guess, the big digital infrastructure that will likely have to be addressed in terms of air traffic management, right? So we see here of provider of services for UAM, PSUs, you know, what types of technology are we talking about? What is their role at a vertiport? Is it at the vertiport? Is it somewhere in between vertiport and kind of the higher airspace? Could you speak to a little bit about that?
Well, that kind of falls into the same realm of, you know, what is the status of vertiports today? You know, so a lot of UTM technologies, uncrewed traffic management system technologies, you know, there's a framework that exists out there. There's a concept of operation that exists, and there's a lot of companies that want to provide support into that system that are around. But, you know, we only see one-off applications of how that works. And so I'm not the expert on that. You know, this is an area where, you know, I'm not as strong as I am, say, on the, you know, the hard infrastructure side of things. But, you know, what I have looked at is, you know, when you look at like supplementary data service providers, you know, that's like the weather systems, you know, how does that communicate with the, you know, with the operator in a UTM environment? And a UTM environment is just supposed to replace or provide a comparable solution as the air traffic management system does today. And so you look at how does an aircraft move through the airspace today? Well, you know, they file flight plans, they establish waypoints, you know, they're looking, talking to controllers, air traffic controllers when they need to, taking directions from them and adjusting course if necessary, you know. And so that whole situation needs to be digitized, you know, through this UTM. And in addition to that, you know, the pilot on board also is essentially a sensor, you know, so that pilot, she's feeling turbulence, you know, she's feeling, you know, seeing icing, you know, starting to form on the wing, you know, seeing different anomalies in how the engine is starting to operate, you know, in different conditions, you know, and, you know, hearing that the radio is not working as well, you know, those are all things that the human sensor picks up, you know, during flight that have to be replicated on these aircraft. And so, kind of bringing it back into more my wheelhouse on the vertiport side of things, you know, what typically exists at an airport, you know, that's going to have to exist there at a future vertiport or a future automated facility or airport with a autonomous operations that are happening at it. And the two big ones that come out of mind there, you know, is the weather information, and two, just a range of different communications protocol needs, C2 needs, you know. And so, you know, aircraft telemetry, you know, aircraft status, you know, when I was in the military as a maintainer, you know, we would sit there and listen for the aircraft status to come down. Alpha one means the airplane was good. We were able to go out and have a beer early. Alpha three means we were in for a long, long night, you know? And so those are the kind of things that are communicated back to the airfield, to the maintenance crews, you know, so how's that taking place? You know, who's doing that kind of communications? And so having robust communications, robust micro weather, would imagine there's, you know, a host more, you know, if you just break down those communications into different pieces, you know, those all typically exist at the airfield. And so it's reasonable to believe that they're going to have to exist at the vertiport, you know. So how are they sited into the vertiport environment? You know, what does that do to the footprint? You know, what kind of sight lines do they need? You know, so on and so forth are all things that we're going to have to take into consideration.
So there's a couple of different things I'd like to talk about here. So I was going to go to sustainability and energy and so forth, which we will. But, you know, given the big push around electric vehicles and the support around sustainability we're seeing definitely at airports in my world, it's a hot topic, right? Continues to be. We've got I don't want to dive into this, so guys, don't do the sigh, but the election is coming up in 2024, right? November. So, yeah, we got some really young guys running this year. So, you know, there's that piece that we have to consider when we're talking about all of this, right? You know, what could get stalled, right? Because of whatever political, you know, whatever. You guys know what I'm talking about. But sorry, I'm half asleep because I came back from Houston, but so I'm struggling with the getting my words out. But, you know, whatever political agendas folks have and so forth, do we see that causing a major issue here and kind of halting the focus around sustainability? Part of it, I see things continuing to move forward, especially in California, right? There should be a lot of support due to the impact around sustainability, how this ties into that. So it's do you see a lot of support for it continuing regardless of the results of the election? Let's start with that at least. Yeah, see, this is what happens when Robbie doesn't sleep.
Yeah, it's hard. I'll kind of tag on to that. It's hard to say, you know, because as we talked about the last in our last podcast, you know, we still don't have an authorization bill. Taking that and then looking, you know, months down the road, saying we also have an election to deal with where priorities might change and things might change. I mean, obviously, it's going to impact something. And, you know, as much as I, you know, said that I'm not the expert on UTMs, you know, politics is certainly, you know, not my forte.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like the focus on sustainability, or at least the momentum, which I know is a different, but within AM, is going to continue. I mean, a lot of these companies have public now, so they have investors, and investors are expecting that they are going to continue to get their aircraft certified. And when their aircraft are certified, I mean, they're going to need places to fly so they can make money, and they're going to need places to, they're going to need vertiports, vertipads. They're going to need places at airports to land, and that will continue. So there may be some minor changes by a change in administration, but overall, I think there still continue to be a drive. I mean, we've lived through two administrations, at least in this advanced air mobility world, and I wouldn't say there was a huge change between the last administration.
Well, I mean, the one thing that you called out, that's like the common denominator, right? Money. That definitely is the the driver there in certain cases, no matter what. So
I mean, I think the guys are right. I think there won't be a huge change with a change in administration at the federal level. I think a lot of this stuff will be hashed out at the local, state and local level. I guess one of my concerns, as we pivot into the topic of energy is, you know, how that topic, you know, sustainability, energy, climate resiliency, those types of things will be addressed through this technology, or can it be addressed, right? I still have my concerns that electrification of aviation is not going to move the needle on us achieving net zero by 2050. Okay, so then, you know, how does that get, to your point, politicized and then funded, right? So I think that's the kind of the game that's going to be played. But to Basil's point, you know, a lot of money has been invested. We got to fly in the next few years, and that pressure is going to be on no matter who is in charge. Make the pivot, Ravi. Make the pivot.
I'm pivoting myself to a bourbon and some glass here. You know, I don't know. You know, from my space, you three are very, very much involved in this space. I'm coming at it from a different perspective, right? In the AEC industry, like, hey, okay, we're focused on this sector, building the infrastructure, planning, design, implementation, and so forth. And we're waiting, right? There's a lot of the architects and engineers jumping in and trying to get involved. We mentioned a few before in a few episodes, like AECOM and others. So it's great. It's great to see that. It's trying to convince a lot more folks to jump in, because where is that reality at? Where's that money at? So like discussions like this really help us understand how real it is, right? What are some of the key concerns that folks have out there, and what could slow it down? So again, it's like, it's good to know about it. It's good to be educated and informed about it, especially with the timing, because then we can shift and get ourselves involved quicker, you know, because again, you're going to need those folks, like the big AE companies out there, to get involved, the ones that can bring the ideas, even the specialty companies, like we talk about wayfinding in airports, right? And cities as well, you know, all that, there's so much that ties into the infrastructure that's going to be necessary to have these eVTOLs land for folks to get to them, whether they want to land there and then they get to an autonomous vehicle. All these other pieces are, they're all moving ahead because there's a lot of work. There's a lot of money from these infrastructure bills that are out there now that, you know, there are efforts ongoing. And again, it's like, I think the smart ones, you know, are listening to folks like you guys and looking at what's happening and the speed it's happening at, and planning for, you know, that future proofing, right? So it's you know, again, I continue to watch this space, and it's just interesting. Even though sometimes I get pessimistic, I don't ignore it, right? So it's important for that to happen. Have you guys seen in a lot of the organizations that you've been with and working with, a lot of the OEMs, have you seen more of a outreach to a lot of the architecture engineering firms that have so much history in developing the infrastructure in cities, airports, metro stations, whatever? Have you seen that continue to tick up, or have you seen it kind of really not change too much over the last few years?
I'll just, my lived experience has been, it hasn't changed. I don't know if it's changed too much. I mean, remember, a lot of these have a startup mindset. And mm-hmm. when you have that mindset, you feel like you can just hire the right people to accomplish it internally.
Sure.
And I think that maybe that's starting to pivot now. But
that's going to happen.
Chris, you're pretty close. Yeah. To this as well. Chris,
yeah. That's going to, I think right now that this is where the infrastructure conversation is kind of happening, right? They're realizing that they cannot solve this internally without engaging outside entities. Those who want to own the entire vertical, I say good luck, because it's going to be a giant undertaking, especially with the funding runways that they have available remaining. So, yeah, I mean, they're going to have to really pivot to not just engaging the city local folks that Clint touched on, and understanding that process, because I think a lot of them don't really understand that process. Part of the other problem is cities, local folks don't deal with aviation. So that's left to an ADO, the airport. And so they don't have the staff to address some of these questions. They'll just kick it over to the airport authority or the ADO. And so there's this kind of inertia right now. Everyone's trying to figure out, who do we talk to? What do we talk to them about? How do we ask a question? Are we asking the right questions? What are the questions to ask? And so they're going to have to really make a concerted effort to really engage a different group of people, not just from a regulatory standpoint, but from a engagement standpoint. Because if not, we're gonna be stuck, really stuck for a while. I'd love to hear Clint, your reactions to my comments, but also your thoughts on that.
Yeah, similar to Basil, I don't think it's really changed a whole lot, and you know, in large part because, you know, most of the large construction and engineering firms, you know, don't really engage in earnest until somebody, you know, has a check right waiting for them. You know, we have a project and exactly. We have funding, and, you know, we ready to sign a contract to pay you money for XYZ services, you know. And so I think, you know, broadly and very generally speaking, you know, the airport construction and engineering firms that, you know, did kind of spin up waiting for, you know, that phone call to say, hey, we're ready and all that kind of stuff, you know, we're probably left waiting a little bit more than they've been comfortable with. And so, you know, looking at, you know, I guess diminishing, you know, their visibility in the space until, you know, that it gets more real, you know, which I think we pointed back to earlier is when we get a certified aircraft. You know, when we get a certified aircraft, then we'll have actual demand, you know, for a vertiport. Until you have actual demand for a vertiport, you know, you're asking somebody, you know, the lenders and financiers on this to take a tremendous amount of risk. And yeah, I would say, you know, in many cases, it probably just doesn't pencil out just yet to engage, you know, that whole chain of folks who are going to be mobilized to make this happen.
Hey, I still appreciate, you know, folks like you, Clint, coming out to talking to the architects and all of us folks in the AEC space. I remember seeing you in LA. What was that? Like 3 months ago?
Yeah.
HOK's office.
November, yeah. I think. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's good. It's good. There's a lot of interest still. I mean, so we're keeping an eye on it, and I appreciate folks like you coming in there and educating us. So it's good.
You know, and I will say, you know, kind of pivoting from the vertiport stuff, you know, so that was kind of a Debbie Downer moment for us, you know, but now we're starting to look at vertiport and eVTOL infrastructure being installed at airports, you know, with the announcement with Atlantic Aviation and Clay Lacy and the airports that are getting on that bandwagon, which, you know, they are going to mobilize, you know, I would imagine, you know, some construction and engineering firms to figure out how that needs to happen. And so, you know, maybe that adds a little bit different flavor to it.
Yeah, we just talked about this the other day. It came up, I forget where I was, probably at the airport. And somebody's like, I wish I could just walk out the terminal and just jump in one of these things. And I'm like, yeah. They're like, maybe we should just go to the FBO, which, of course, that's where, you know, most realistic starting point would be at the airport would be the FBO, not the terminal, of course. But yeah. I would love that today, believe me. I would have just jumped in there instead of walking through the terminal and getting out there and trying to flag down a ride.
But I have always been a proponent of leveraging our airports, you know, in this system. And, you know, I think there's solutions all around where, you know, I think maybe we talked about it last time, but, you know, in terms of, you know, where does it make sense to put a vertiport and where and why airports don't make sense in that space? You know, a lot of people will argue that, well, you know, the final destinations of people that are going to be using this transportation system, you know, want to go places that are further away from the airport. You know, and my argument on that is that, yeah, that's true. You know, so we've identified a need there, you know, so either we need to bring aviation closer to the destinations or we need to bring the destinations closer to aviation. And I think there's a two-prong approach there that has a lot of viability. And I've seen some airports in northern Utah, you know, without recognizing, you know, AAM as a potential use case in the future, have seen, hey, you know, we can do a lot of good for our airport by, one, protecting it by having a plan, you know, that encourages compatible use around the airport, and not just compatible, but complementing use, you know, for the airport. And that could be, you know, for some airports, it can be like corporate type of uses. You know, if you look at Amsterdam, you know, many airports, you know, anchor industrial hubs and industrial operations. You know, that's something that can be totally be complemented and planned in a strategic way. But, you know, airports identified for air taxi uses, you know, where are their customers going? You know, and is it possible to plan those uses near the airport? So not only can you just get off at the FBO and walk in, but you can walk out the other door and, you know, walk a block down the road to your shared working place or your conference center or wherever it is, you know, that you're going to.
I'm sure there's like a lot of eyes on what's happening with the electric vehicles, right? And charging infrastructure and some of the issues and the unhappiness of some of the electric car owners that they have around the lack of charging stations, right? For their Teslas or whatever electric vehicle they have. What's the OEM industry or the AAM space? What are they looking at right now? Are they really focused on that right now? And kind of like, whoa, okay, we've really got to get a handle on this. And they're looking to those folks on the surface side, right? Those autonomous vehicles, electric cars to hopefully push folks quickly to get to address those issues, those challenges, that electrical infrastructure that we really need, or the charging infrastructure.
Yeah. And I think with that, you know, some good, robust origin destination mapping of, you know, where people are departing airports from and where they're going. And we did that in Utah. You can look that up online. We did an economic impact study and an airport system plan, which together we coined as the aviation development strategy. And we looked at the origin destination data to see for each airport, where are people going, where are they coming from, you know, and are there economic ties, you know, that we can pull from that. You know, so kind of taking that perspective and, you know, acknowledging that some of these aircraft are going to have shorter range. And now I'm talking about not just eVTOLs, but I'm talking about electric aircraft, the electric conventional takeoff and landing aircraft, and even the electric short takeoff and landing aircraft, you know, bringing in, you know, the other technologies under this umbrella. You know, when we were looking at this in Northern Utah, we were looking at the airport outside of Logan, Utah, which is, you know, where Utah State University is located at, who has a very large flight school. And they were at the time interested in, you know, what it might, what the benefits might be if they transitioned a portion of their fleet to electric motors, you know, to make the training a little bit less expensive for students who were just needed stick and rudder time, you know. And so that was a great solution for that airport, because the students would take off, they'd fly around, beat up the pattern a little bit, and they'd come right back. And typically they'd only, you know, spend anywhere from 30 minutes to an hour in the air anyways, you know. And so it was a really good use case, you know, but we wanted to look past that and say, all right, well, that's good to get things started at this one airport, you know, but if we want to create a network, you know, where are they going next, you know, and is there, you know, a route that we need to look at of airports along the way where they need to have charging infrastructure installed, you know. And so if, say if somebody was leaving Logan and another end of the node was Henderson, you know, in Las Vegas, you know, where would they need to charge to go from Logan, Utah to Las Vegas, Nevada? And, you know, could we target those airports for electric charging infrastructure in the future and start incorporating that into our capital development plans? You know, and so it was a very interesting exercise. And then that even led into multimodal, you know, because as the state was also looking at, you know, is there viability in electrifying, you know, some of our primary and secondary trucking routes? And so we overlaid our route that we looked at with those routes, and there's a lot of synergies and overlaps, you know. And so, all right, well, if we need to charge or create charging infrastructure, you know, of significant scale out in the middle of rural Utah, you know, rather than competing for resources and labor and all the things that we talked about earlier in the program, you know, right, why don't we work together and see if we can't make multimodal facilities, you know, that are airports, you know, for the electric aircraft, but also, you know, even truck stops, you know, that are sited adjacent, you know, to serve the truckers. And, you know, if you're going to have a truck stop with a Buc-ee's, you know, why not have that Buc-ee's also serve the airports? Buc-ee's.
You know, yeah. I got a Buc-ee's in our house right now. It's a Buc-ee's Yeti or whatever it is. My wife and daughter went to Alabama to visit my in-laws. They come back with a Buc-ee's cup. I'm like, that's great. And a Buc-ee's sweatshirt too. But now I'm like, did you eat the sandwiches? They're like, no. I'm like, well, what the hell are you going to Buc-ee's for? Not eating.
You missed out the experience.
Hey, you've written a few articles that I've tracked over the, I guess, last couple of years. In particular, was it about the scooters or the bikes, kind of the lessons learned in how we have to plan for these new, you know, modes of transportation, but also how we engage with the local community and the public, right? Could you give us a quick highlight on that article, but also, you know, your thoughts on, you know, what are some lessons we've learned recently in the last, you know, decade of bringing these new ways of moving around the 15, developing the 15 minute city. What are those lessons that we need to be keeping front and center?
Well, you know, we're two pack podcasts into it, and you haven't learned that I can't do anything quickly.
Nice.
Yeah, and I can't recall the specific article you're talking about, but I know I've talked about this, you know, in many different forums and, you know, different articles and stuff, you know. So, you know, we can go back to the origin, you know, of my work in Los Angeles. And so, you know, essentially, I'll try and make it quick. You know, what happened was, is, you know, 2012 comes around, ride sharing appears on the streets, you know, got drivers just driving around, you know, waiting for a pickup, you know, creates a, you know, a new challenge for the city to deal with in terms of planning and infrastructure and curb management and the whole nine yards, you know. And so, you know, the city tried to deal with it, but by that time, you know, a lot of regulation had already been preempted by the state. And so it was left the city, you know, really struggling to figure out, you know, what is the best solution for integrating this new technology into the landscape of the city so that it is an actual complement to the city and not a burden. You know, and so there's a lot of lessons learned from 2012 and the introduction of ride sharing. And then you fast forward to 2017, electric scooters just appeared out of nowhere, like literally overnight, you know, all over cities across the nation, you know. And so
I remember that.
Went right back into this whole, you know, this technology is here. What do we do with it? How do we plan? We had some lessons learned from the ride sharing experience, you know, and so they got to work on, you know, starting to adapt and, you know, again, taking those lessons learned and saying, all right, well, we know what we wanted to do last time. Let's get a rush on that. And, you know, so I would say scooters are integrated a little bit better into the cities than ride sharing, you know, initially was, you know. And so what that gave recognition to within the city was, is that transportation technologies is evolving. You know, the whole landscape is evolving. You know, new disruptive technologies are going to continue to come, you know, and cities can either take a stance where they fight against it and put their head in the sand and don't, you know, don't want to do anything about it, or they're going to actually understand what the technology is, you know, and how it might actually complement the city and work with the city and all that. And so that's how Urban Movement Labs, you know, was initially created, was, you know, as an arm in the city that could reach out to the industry on not just urban air mobility and advanced air mobility, but, you know, all modes of disruptive transportation technology and understand, hey, what are you trying to accomplish? You know, and here's what our actual challenges are. Here's where we're struggling at, you know, and maybe your technology is a solution to some of these challenges, you know, so that it makes our jobs easier and it makes you successful, you know, so there's, you know, got to be some synergies in this landscape somewhere. And so that was the spirit, you know, by which, you know, my work started in Los Angeles, was trying to figure out and learning from these past mistakes and experiences that happened with these other disruptive transportation technologies. And figuring out, you know, what are those threads that exist, you know, within advanced air mobility that we can, you know, get ahead of this and understand how it's actually going to work for the city, you know. And some of the things that evolved, you know, with scooters in particular was the digital infrastructure, you know, the mobility data specification that the city uses to understand where scooters are at, how they're being used, you know, what are their origins, what are their destinations, all that stuff, you know. And so can we create that digital infrastructure, you know, that was created for the scooters and actually apply it, you know, there are other applications to drones and advanced air mobility, you know. And so I think there's the Los Angeles is an awesome city, you know, and the people that work there are amazing. You know, I've never met people that are as passionate about their city, you know, as in Los Angeles. You know, the planners there love that city. And I was inspired, you know, every single day by those folks, you know. And so they really want to do what's best for the city. And I think it's frustrating sometimes when, you know, someone comes along with a solution, you know, that doesn't have a really well-defined problem and just tries to you know, break down doors and, you know, and just get it out there. You know, so what, how do we plan? What do we plan for? I mean, that's going to be different for every city.
Just for the record, Clint is saying LA more than I have. So just letting out.
that is true. That is
LA
true.
Will always have a place in my heart. I miss it. Yeah, you know, still.
Sounds like Clint is pushing for.
Come on back, man. Three. Come on back. Wait, three. Wait, wait a week. Wait a week. Come back.
Yeah, no, you nailed it, man. I can't agree with you more. Feel like we have a bunch of shiny objects, and we're looking for a problem to solve. And I would love for folks to come together to really understand, you know, what problem we're trying to solve here with not just AM, but future mobility at large. And the problem is not going to be the same for every city. It's going to be different and a conversation for another day, but you nailed it. So with that, I know we're coming up on time here.
Part three, man, we need to go back.
Part three. So much to talk about, we need to do like a spring, summer, fall, winter, year-round Clint episode. Over to the fun question, guys. Let's do it.
Fun question. Okay. Well, the Eagles are going to win. Oh, wait. Okay. They're not in that. Okay. Well, so here's one. Question. Here's one. So we get the halftime. Who's the halftime show this year anyway? I don't even know who's playing halftime.
Taylor Swift.
She's not.
That was Usher.
I have no idea. Usher. Yeah.
Oh, God. He's talented, but kind of boring. All right. So your ideal halftime show, who would it be? Any artists? Talking about anybody from like the birth of music. It doesn't matter if they're alive or dead, you know, whatever. Who would it be? So I'll throw this over. Chris, since you're in Sri Lanka, I'll throw it over to you first.
Yeah, man, I'm ready to. I guess wake up.
Some pretty good ones in the past.
Years ago, we've had a bunch of good ones. Snoop Dogg,
Dr. Dre, and
Eminem. Oh, yeah. That was the best one. That was the best one. Oh, it happened in L.A. Eminem and Snoop Dogg. Yeah. In L.A.
Oh, my goodness.
Nice.
I say Michael Jackson. I've always wanted to see him in concert. I would love to see Michael Jackson.
He did halftime a long time ago. Like, way long ago.
Oh, man. I don't remember it. I would love to see him again.
Yeah, I think you guys were in grade school.
Oh, man.
Where were you, in high school or were you in college at that point?
I was married. I'm just kidding. I forget what year that was. I'll look it up. All right, Basil, what about you? So Michael Jackson, that's a good one. That's a really good one, actually.
Ooh, that is a good one. All right, dead or alive. When you said dead or alive, I mean, there's lots of great, like, the folks that have, artists that have died.
There we go. He's going to pick somebody obscure, some Hawaiian artist, maybe.
Yeah, Israel Kamaka Vivoli. No.
John Cruise, man. He's good.
I would probably, you know, Elvis would be probably pretty impressive to see.
Wow.
But
that's a good one.
Actually, I'm going to take that back. I think.
Young Elvis.
Yeah, no, I'll go with the. I don't know. The old Elvis was, probably the older Elvis.
Wow. That would have been.
I don't know if you've seen like some of his.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, obviously they had the movie that came out recently, or not recently, last five years. So, yeah.
Or 2 years ago. That's a great one. Actually, that's a
But he was an really entertainer, man. He was an entertainer. Yeah. He could.
I mean, that's how do you think I swivel my hips? That's exactly where I learned it from.
Oh, boy.
That would be, you know what? Honestly, that probably would be Taylor Swift level if Elvis was out there, you know, in his heyday. That's a really good one, Basil. Clint, what about you, man?
You know, I was thinking about it, and I was about to go with my favorite band, which would be Pink Floyd. And if we're going dead, in the past, it would be with Roger Waters. But I don't know if Pink Floyd's, you know, the right band for a Super Bowl.
In LA, definitely some weed.
They could just be playing the whole Super Bowl game in the background.
There you go.
Pink Floyd, you know.
Yeah, but what I ended up with is, so I like, you know, the halftime show in LA with Snoop and everybody and having that kind of collage. Yeah. And so I was thinking, all right, well, let's go back to like Black Sabbath and AC/DC and have a similar collage, you know, back in the day as a halftime show, really get that energy going, you know? And, so that's my final answer.
I love it. I love that. Like, you know, I was going to say Iron Maiden, like the heavy metal bands of the,
has there ever been crazy. Like a real heavy metal band for, I don't think there has been.
I don't think AC/DC never did it, right? No.
No.
No. I think we would have remembered.
I mean, has Metallica ever played? I mean, they're not. I wouldn't say
I don't think so.
I don't think so. I mean, I think you got some of those bands that are like, you know, their hardcore fan base is like, don't do it. Don't do it, you know. But like, for once, you know, they'll never like really ease up on that. I think they'll always give them a hard time. For me, it's Beastie Boys. I'd love the Beastie Boys.
Ooh, nice.
That is a good one.
Yeah, I know they're not all together, obviously, you know, but they would have been amazing. They would never have done it. They would never jump in there and do that. So they would have been awesome to watch. But
that's awesome.
That's a good one, Robbie.
I know.
All right. Know. This has been great.
Also, let's see. Oh, my daughter's running down the steps here. Hey, my daughter's running these steps. Hey, if you had a halftime show in the Super Bowl, who would you want to see?
Taylor Swift.
Yeah.
You don't want to see Taylor Swift at the halftime? What? You love Taylor Swift. What? Okay, I don't need an explanation or not. Just pick an artist. Who? Hootie and Blowfish. Oh, my gosh.
Oh, my God.
Well, this took a turn.
Yeah,
all right, guys. So this is a lesson for our listeners. When you talk to a 14-year-old and you ask her a question, Britney Spears, biggest comeback of all time. Oh my god! All right, she did buy her book. So okay, all right, you can keep talking. All right, guys, let's wrap it up. Yeah, can we just do the outro? 14-year-old, can you please? Hey guys, thanks for listening to the Know U Turn podcast.
Special thanks to our editor, Abby Joyner, and our artwork designer, Carrie Ann Fernando. If you want to check us out on Instagram, do a search for @NoUturn_podcast. And also on LinkedIn, do a search for No U-Turn Podcast. We're available pretty much on any platform where you enjoy your podcast listening, such as Apple, Spotify, Buzzsprouts, and many others. So we'll see you next time. Keep it on the center line.